This is Future of Water, where we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're going to talk about private water ownership. More specifically, fair market value policies and their impacts, real or not so real, on utility acquisitions in the U.S. specifically. I'll be joined today by Marielle Marchand, an analyst with Bluefield Research, who can definitely talk us through the ins and outs of what we call FMV legislation across the various states. Let's kick it off with some news items and takes. These, for those of you not in the know, some of these are delivered through Bluefield Research's Waterline newsletter. Every Wednesday, you can get news items. You can just go to our website, bluefieldresearch.com, and register. Simply put, give us your email, and we'll send you every Wednesday some takeaways, including chart of the month, the news items, and presentations, and so on and so forth. All good stuff, but just give it a shot when you get a chance. So, news item number one, Badger Meter has announced acquisition of Analytical Technology, a privately held water quality monitoring system provider. They paid $44 million for the company that had approximately $22 million in revenues in 2020. ATI really specializes in the design and manufacturing of water quality instruments based on electrochemical and optical sensors. Why do we care? Well, this is second acquisition in about a month by Badger Meter, which, as the name says, it's traditionally a metering company. So they acquired S-Can about a month ago, which pushed them into the software space, and now they are acquiring ATI. So two deals. I know my colleague Nina Rossiter, who's an analyst at Bluefield, would definitely be interested in speaking with you if you're interested. She has just put out some research on Badger Meter, and I know we've also put out some recent profiles on them as well on our website to our Insight Service clients. So interesting, really, to say that Badger Meter is going beyond just metering and expanding into other areas. In addition, ATI also has a position outside of the U.S., but also in Europe. News item number two, for the second time in 2 weeks, Black & Veatch has made the list. This time, it has sold Etonix Digital to members of the latter's management team. Etonix, I think Black & Veatch spun it out as a standalone business unit about 3 years ago. And it's really focused on monitoring and diagnostic services that was combined into a software called Asset 360. So the cloud-based software leverages data and analytics to help businesses, utilities, help them with asset management and asset optimization. But what's interesting is it seems like Black & Veatch is, one, not only cleaning house a little bit. That's not to say that it isn't focused on digital water. In fact, it has other digital solutions, which I think are more core to its digital water business. Etonix has, and water specifically, has struggled a bit to really get off the ground. I think it did better in other infrastructure sectors. But this is the second deal. As I mentioned 1 or 2 weeks ago on the Future Water podcast, specifically that Black & Veatch had sold its UK and Southeast Asia positions to RSK and renamed it Benny's. That's underway right now, and I know there's a little bit of a hustle and bustle on the back end when it comes to intellectual property and how things are going to be divided up once that's all said and done. So lots happening on the engineering front. I might also add that Bluefield Research does have a report on digital water for engineering companies looking at competitive positioning, how they're positioned when it comes to solutions, but also what are their channels to market. We've done a lot of analysis in this segment, so it might be worth reaching out to Bluefield. Eric Bendler is the one who leads that. Last item, Suez gets a $13.7 billion proposal to challenge Veolia's proposal for Suez. Ardian and Global Infrastructure Partners, I think they've basically put it out there that they're willing to offer 11.3 billion euros, 13.7 billion US dollar equivalent for Suez, which the saga continues, should I say. Like I said at the beginning when we did a podcast on this, I think Bluefield's also put out a research note. Culturally, this is going to be a challenge. The number one and two water companies in the world going head to head. The question is, Ardian has been in the mix since the very beginning as a potential suitor. Is it a stalking horse for the remaining 70% of the company? Veolia already owns now 29.9% of the company. So Veolia has, it's planning to offer 18 euros per Suez share for the remainder of Suez, the other essentially 70%. But I think some of it also does hinge on Suez has put in place a poison pill of sorts that makes life a little bit difficult, but Veolia wants to make sure that Suez doesn't sell off certain assets in Spain, Chile, the US, UK, Australia. But this is going to drag on for a little while. Although the first 30% went pretty quickly, we'll see what happens here. But there you have it. A couple takeaways from this week to keep you up to date in the news. It's obviously not all of it. On the back end, I know Bluefield, our team, we're sort of going through some strategy discussions right now to better serve not only our insight clients, but the market as a whole, because we do track a lot of news and insights, and keep your eyes and ears open. May take a little while, may take the better part of Q1 to work through the system, but hey, that's the way it goes. But let's cut to the matter at hand. I am joined today by my colleague, Mariel Marchand. So let's do it. Mariel, how's it going?
Pretty good, Reese. It's inauguration day, so it's pretty exciting.
It should be exciting. It's going to be kind of weird. I don't know how it's going to play out. You know, one, how many people are going to be there? Washington is in seemingly military lockdown, which is an issue in and of itself. But yeah, exciting. If anything, it's change, right? So a change, some people might think it's bad. Some people might think it's good. But I think change is usually a good thing, particularly when it comes to politics. But awesome. So today we're going to talk a little bit about private water. This is sort of your bailiwick, as they say. This is something you've looked a lot at from quarter to quarter when it comes to deal flow. But one of the questions that has come up recently is fair market value policies. And so this is supposed to be a driver for utility acquisitions and, I guess, potential activity. Can you give me the basics? Like, what is fair market value or fair market value legislation, as we call it?
Yeah, so fair market value allows investor-owned utilities acquiring system assets to recover an independently appraised fair market value through their rate base. So basically, in states that haven't adopted the policy, municipal assets can only be acquired at the book value, which is often highly depreciated due to the age of the water and wastewater system assets that are being acquired. And this means that IOUs acquiring systems can only add the original cost of the assets, less depreciation, to their rate base. And also, since the original cost of the assets does not include contributed assets like distribution and collection networks that are oftentimes transferred to municipalities after being installed and paid for by private developers, these wouldn't contribute to that value. They wouldn't contribute value to that rate base either. So the policy is really intended to incentivize public and, in some cases, private utilities, depending on the state and how its legislation is structured, to sell their assets at a higher price that reflects the fair market value of those assets. And just to give you a quick idea of how widely the policy has been adopted, so far, only 12 states have implemented fair market value, 8 of which have adopted the policy between 2015 and 2020. California was the first state to adopt fair market value in 1997, and Virginia was the most recent in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because I think that point in and of itself, some of the dates you just talked about, it's all relatively new, right? I think that's a big part of it. You know, to enact policies takes a while to play out. So if you're saying 8 of 12 have happened since 2015, that's obviously the majority. But I think even the companies involved, you can correct me if I'm wrong in a little bit maybe, but companies involved need to get up to speed on it, what it means, but also the regulators, right? I think, you know, and it seems like every policy is a little bit different. There's some nuance state by state. So one of the questions I have, though, this came up last week or 2 weeks ago with colleagues in a meeting. I'm a public utility and I sell at a higher price, it's supposed to benefit the seller as well, right? It's supposed to, one, drive deal flow because sellers are more likely to engage in a conversation or negotiation about a sale because they're going to get higher rates. So that's good for the municipalities, but aren't the costs passed off to the ratepayers ultimately?
Yeah, the cost of the acquisition is ultimately passed off to the ratepayers through that higher rate base. But there are mechanisms that can be implemented to mitigate higher rates. We have seen deals approved under fair market value that include agreements to keep the rates as they are for a set number of years before starting what is often an incremental increase over a set number of years. And we see that with deals that aren't fair market value as well, but that's just one of the strategies. One case in particular that comes to mind, though, is Aqua Pennsylvania's acquisition of Delcora. Delcora has agreed to put the proceeds from the sale of the assets into what they are calling the Delcora Customer Trust Fund, which they will then use to provide payment assistance for customer bills. So the intention is to keep customer bills at a 3% annual increase until the money in the trust fund runs out. Also, another point to keep in mind is that even in most cases where the proceeds of the sales aren't put in a trust to mitigate rate increases, the funds are generally used by the municipality to make some kind of investment that benefits its citizens. We've seen examples of things like new community centers being built or municipalities using the funds to pay down debt to improve their credit rating. And recently, as municipalities are facing lower tax revenues, they're also using proceeds to cover budget deficits.
Yeah, I think it's the Delcora deal, which I don't believe is closed. I think we talked a little bit about this the other day, but it's interesting. And I think that fund, correct me if I'm wrong, rates were supposed to remain at least steady or at a flat increase maybe for 7-8 years, something like that. Do you recall?
Yeah, I think they were predicting like 8 to 10 years until that trust fund runs out.
Right. So, and I think part of this discussion is there are other contentious reasons for the delay. I don't know if it is a delay in this deal, you know, with Aqua and the local agency. But I think the other issue is they were going to have to make big investments anyways. I think that was the other thing. So rates were probably going to rise with or without Aqua. And so I think to your point, that's what I'm sort of following up on is a lot of times there is a big looming bill coming due that the city or utility is going to have to pay. And so one, they can sort of go to market, sell the assets, get a higher price for it, but then the same costs are going to be passed off to the ratepayers anyway. So maybe it comes out in the wash, but let's just go back to FMV policies, fair market value. What's the skinny? 12 states, 8 of which happened since 2015. Are they driving deal flow?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Going back through Bluefield's data set of acquisitions, we were able to identify 58 fair market value deals since 2015, which really isn't that many given that we track 130 deals per year. So to your question, two companies account for 52 of the 58 deals that we identified. Those companies, maybe not surprisingly, are American Water and Aqua America. These are two companies that are really at the forefront of lobbying efforts to pass policies that incentivize system acquisitions within their service territories. So not just fair market value, there are other policies being passed as well. And one of the reasons that we don't see some of the other acquisitive players, like Central States, for example, making acquisitions under fair market value is because a number of the companies that we track are focused more on systems that are privately owned, which, depending on the state, are not applicable to fair market value. I think only about half of the states that we looked at include private systems in their fair market value legislation. Players like Central States are also looking to acquire systems that are distressed, where the private owner doesn't have the capability or oftentimes even the interest to run the system, and therefore doesn't need that incentive of a higher price tag to sell. And just one last point, most of the deals that we identified occurred in only 3 states, despite 12 states having adopted the policy. Those states are Pennsylvania, Illinois, and California. So in a nutshell, fair market value is pretty limited to a few companies and a few states.
Yikes. So, I mean, we've talked about this at Bluefield, like, hey, fair market value policies are going to drive deal flow. And they are driving deal flow, but it's limited to, like you said, two companies in three states. Part of that is they're well established in their understanding. You know, one, I think it takes experience. Like I said, the regulator needs to understand it. Pennsylvania is where Aqua and American is. That's sort of the epicenter of all of their deals. So, you know, the market is well aware of who they are. California has been in place for a while. Illinois, similarly, it's been there for a little while as well. So what you're telling me, though, and this is a discussion we had internally, policy, is it overhyped in its impact?
Well, I guess I'd say that not all states are created equal. As I just mentioned, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and California are really the ones experiencing the bulk of the deal flow under the legislation. That can at least somewhat be attributed to how the legislation is structured in those states, among a few other factors that we looked at while doing the research for the report on this. That being said, Texas could emerge as a new state to watch. It just enacted the policy in 2019. And as we know from going through the dockets each quarter, Texas has really high deal flow. So there might be some opportunity there. There have already been two deals filed under fair market value this year, or I guess in 2020. And also public utilities, those utilities owned by municipalities, are facing financial headwinds in the aftermath of COVID. If they are strapped, they're more likely to consider selling, particularly if they're able to get more value for the sale. So that could be something to keep an eye on moving forward as well.
Yeah, I think that's important. One thing we've looked at for a while, deals take a long time to work their way through the digestive tract, so to speak, 200 plus days. But also, like you said, you know, the impacts of COVID. I was actually just listening to another podcast this morning before recording this about the infrastructure bill that's being proposed in Congress and what that means, and talked a little bit about certain states and or cities, which ones are going to be impacted. And typically in cities, there's no one around. You walk through, whether it be New York or Chicago or Boston or San Francisco, it's pretty quiet out there. A lot of restaurants are closed, so there's a lot less tax revenue. If it's a non-income tax state, and you know, Florida is another example, you know, a lot of states are going to be impacted. Now, Florida's not an FMV state, but Illinois obviously is, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We'll see what happens with the publics, both small and large, right? They're going to be financially strapped. It will take time, but like you said, or have said in the past, 60 to 70% of deal flow is private, right? I think it's a private buying a private of all the deals we track. And like you said, 130 on average, give or take a couple every year. So one question that I do have for you to kind of add is, and I don't believe you mentioned this, the prices of the deals that the IOUs are paying, they are higher, am I correct, than what we're seeing traditionally on average?
Yeah, absolutely. They are higher. I think it's about like 58% higher is what we're seeing with the fair market value deals compared to the rest of the deal flow that we're tracking.
Yes, that's sort of the proof is in the pudding, right? Of those 58 deals that we've looked at, they're 58% higher on average than what we've seen for the others. That benefits the seller. Okay, well, now that I think this report, if it's not out today or tomorrow, it definitely will be by the time this podcast drops. If it's not, we've got other problems because it's pretty in-depth. I think it's well done. So I look forward to talking to more people about that. So now that you've done that, what else is going on? What's on your plate research-wise?
So I've been working on a report about OPEX. So looking at what's driving operating costs and utility spending. So we're planning to break out the different categories of spending within utility budgets to really zoom in on how much utilities are spending on things like labor, energy, digital technologies, just to name a few. And we'll also consider the impact of COVID and the associated economic downturn on operating expenditures. The report will include a forecast, but more broadly, it'll look at what's driving this shift towards services that we've been expecting and talking about in some publications that we've put out recently.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, you know, historically we've looked at, well, we have looked at historical CapEx spending and OpEx and sort of how they've been impacted by recessions. And as we've talked to a number of times about, OpEx seems to do a bit better as far as, you know, being more resilient. And I think even there's a divergence between CapEx and OpEx, meaning that OpEx seems to be climbing at a faster rate while CapEx seems to be flagging a bit. And with the recession, will there be some deferments, particularly in the absence of stimulus? So I know companies like Infomark, who was just recently acquired by New Mountain, Veolia, Suez, Jacobs, they see opportunities. They have varying strategies in targeting OpEx, you know, kind of what's their spearhead. Some use OpEx as a spearhead to sell technology. Some use technologies as a spearhead to sell OpEx. And then some just do, or O&M, should I say, instead of OpEx. But Infomark, you know, its strategy is really just focus on services. They're not selling technologies. They're just trying to sort of roll up, you know, services and service contracts. So, but that it all plays within the OpEx landscape. So I look forward to learning more about that. I've already seen some of the forecasts and we've talked about different scenarios and what it all means, whether it be by geography or water versus wastewater and so on and so forth. So, all right, Mariel. So thanks a million for stepping up early in the morning on Inauguration Day. So like I said, that's exciting. And this will drop, I believe, next week. So look forward to hearing it in person on the Future of Water. I guess I should say goodbye to you. So have a good day and we'll talk soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Reese.
All right. And before we sign off, please subscribe. You can do it on iTunes, Spotify, and all the other podcast platforms. Give us a review. I think iTunes lets you give a review or a rating of the podcast. Come on, give it to us. We need it. It helps and enables us to keep doing this. If you have topics or themes or things that you want covered on the podcast, you can always send us a note at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. Send us any idea. We're doing this for you, not us, because we can always go in the conference room or a Zoom chat and talk amongst ourselves. And lastly, just tell a friend about it. The more people that listen, the better off we do, the more we can do. And on and on and on the wheel goes. But this podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by Bluefield Research. To learn more about us and all the things we do, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. All right, everybody. Talk soon. Thanks.